Welcome or welcome back, podcast tours to Horse for Whore. I'm Mariah.
And I'm Kayla.
And this week we are starting our They Didn't Do It, Should They Be Exonerated series, and I'm going first.
What was yours on?
My person is Cameron Todd Willingham.
Okay. I don't think I've heard of him.
It's a heartbreaker, and I've read through my notes a couple times, and I've cried every single time. So if I start to cry, we're just going to take a break
and, you know, come back. Our weekends have already not been good. This is not a good episode.
Yeah, we're having a bit of a rough time. Yeah. So maybe I just need a good cry sesh. Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah, that's fair.
So before we get started, I do want to give a quick shout out to The New Yorker. They have an amazing article called Trial by Fire by David Gran. It's very detailed. Basically, all my notes come from this. If you want more detail, go look at that article and we'll have it linked. On December 23rd, 1991, in Corsicana, Texas, an 11-year-old girl named Buffy Barbie was playing in her backyard when she suddenly smelled smoke. Startled, she quickly ran inside and told her mother, Diane Barbie, and the two of them hurried up the street to investigate. Just a few houses down from their own, they saw the Willingham home in flames. Cameron Todd Willingham was standing on the front porch wearing only a pair of jeans, with his chest black from soot and his hair and eyelids singed. Yes. He was screaming, quote, my babies are burning up. His children, Carmen and Cameron, yes, he has a daughter named after him, but his name starts with a C and her name starts with a K, which still, Carmen and Cameron. Odd choices.
I like it.
They were one-year-old twins, and his two-year-old daughter named Amber were all still trapped inside the home.
Where's the mom?
She's out shopping. Okay. She'll come to play. So Cameron saw Diane and her daughter, and he yelled at them to go call the fire department. The Barbies rushed back down the street to their home while Cameron searched for a way into the house. He found a stick and broke the children's bedroom window, but fires burst through and he couldn't get in.
Ew.
So he walked around, he busted another window, and the same thing happened. He stepped back into the yard and collapsed into a kneeling position in front of the house. A witness later told police that he intermittently would cry out, my babies, before falling silent as if he, quote, blocked the fire out of his mind.
Well, yeah.
I mean,
you have your children burn in a fire in front of your eyes.
Yeah, and I don't think that, and this is the 90s again, and so everyone's like, oh, the way he reacted. I don't think that there's a status quo reaction for this, right? Three children are burning alive. Yeah. There isn't a good way to react.
Yeah, and that's kind of what comes into play with my case, too. They're like, oh, the way she reacted at their gravestones. Like, what?
It makes me a lot more, not happy, but I do feel a lot more comfortable that society's kind of like, hey, the way you react doesn't mean you're guilty or not guilty, you know? Like, it's just everyone reacts differently.
Yeah. When your children are murdered, you know, or set on fire in front of your face, then you tell me how you would react.
Yeah.
And I'm going to tell you what's wrong. Jackass.
So, meanwhile, Diane Barbie had finished phoning the fire department and she returned to the Willingham home. She reported that she could feel the intense heat from the house before she could even see it. So, like, this fire is burning hot.
It's hot, yeah.
Yeah. Moments
after... Wait. Does that mean that there was, like, an igniter?
Oh, we'll get to it. Don't speculate yet.
Okay.
So, moments after she arrived, the five windows of the children's room exploded and flames blew out, as Barbie put it in her interview. So just minutes after all of these windows exploded, the first firemen arrive on the scene and Cameron ran up to them shouting that his children were still in their bedroom where the flames were the thickest.
Uh-oh.
So more firefighters and rescue workers show up. They begin, you know, uncoiling the hose and trying to put out the fire, spraying it down. One fireman attempted to enter the home, but he had to back out because he was actually hit with water. Like, so they're just spraying it everywhere, trying to get it to come out.
Mm-hmm.
The same guy tried to go through the front door, and he made it in. So he walked down the main hallway of the home, and he reached the kitchen, where he oddly saw a refrigerator blocking the back door. So there's two fridges in the home.
Okay.
So, meanwhile, while this guy's inside, Cameron is outside watching this entire scene, and he's growing more and more, quote, hysterical, as the article put it. A police, yeah, I don't even know. So a police chaplain named George Monahan led Cameron to the back of the fire truck to try and calm him down. So Cameron explains to this guy that his wife Stacy had actually gone out earlier that morning to get the girls Christmas gifts from the Salvation Army. And he'd been asleep, but woke up to the house being on fire and his daughter Amber screaming, "Daddy, Daddy." And so Cameron was obviously besides himself, and he told George that, quote, "My little girl was trying to wake me up to tell me about the fire. I couldn't get my babies out," end Wait. Quote.
But if she's by your bed waking you up, where did she go?
Well, we'll get to that, because that's part of it. So, as they were talking, a fireman emerged from the home carrying Amber. She was found in the master bedroom where Cameron was sleeping. And so Cameron got up and headed towards Amber and the fireman who was giving her CPR, but then he, like, turned and made a mad dash towards the house.
Cameron did?
Yeah, the dad. So he sees Amber, is, like, super freaked out and, like, starts to run towards her and then immediately turns to run towards the house.
Okay, that can be explained by he's trying to go get his other kids.
Yeah, one of them's out. Maybe he could get the other two. Yeah. But the fire was raging out of control right now, and he wasn't equipped to go in there. And, like, as it stands, he's looking like he's the only survivor. So they need him to get the entire story, as sad as that is. Like, they can't let this guy go at all.
Well, they can't let him go in there at all anyway.
Yeah. So the fireman had to try and hold him back, but Cameron was, you know, so strong and so emotional that they ended up having to wrestle him to the ground and handcuff him.
I just don't understand the point of running in now versus before the firefighters came.
Yeah,
Like, obviously it's worse. You couldn't get in before, so why are you going to take off running now?
Yeah, and I don't know if he is, like, hysterical. I mean, I would be fucking hysterical, you know?
Yeah.
And a fireman later told the police that he'd received a black eye and, quote, "based on what I saw and how the fire was burning, it would have been crazy for anyone to try and go into the house."
End yeah, but quote. He's, like, basically a grieving father at this point.
Yeah.
So I mean, logically speaking, it's dumb, but, I mean, he's probably going to do it anyway.
And I feel like a grieving father, your children are dying before your eyes. You know that they're dying. All logic is out the window at this point, right? Like, this well, yeah, dude has
he wouldn't
no
care
sense.
At this point. Yeah. He would just run in, which, yeah, that's fine. I get that. Like,
yeah.
That's fine. Before, when I said that, logically speaking, like, you couldn't get in before when the fire was not as bad.
So why would you run in now?
But no, I get it. Obviously, you don't care anymore. You're just going to run
in. Yeah. You just want to see get your babies.
Who got the black eye?
A random fireman that was trying to hold Cameron down stop him. So ultimately, all three children had died. Amber, who had been found in the master bedroom, had died of smoke inhalation.
Mm-hmm.
And the twins, Carmen and Cameron, were found on the floor of the children's bedroom. Their bodies were severely burned, but according to the medical examiner, they died of smoke inhalation, so they likely died before their bodies were burned, which is tragic, but I mean, that's the only blessing, if you can even call it that. Like, I would rather have someone die of smoke inhalation than being burned to death, right?
Yeah. No, and that's the thing, like, with fires, you're more than likely, even if you get out, you're more than likely to die from smoke inhalation.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think it takes very long for it to become irreversible, so. And their body, so that means that they were probably already dead. of smoke inhalation before he broke the window to their bedroom. And their bodies were probably burned because he broke the window to the bedroom, letting in the oxygen and forcing the flames out.
Well, the fire, we'll learn later, likely originated from their room.
Okay.
So, and the fire was most concentrated at their room. Like, where the flames were the thickest was their room. And I have to say, like, all of the smoke is pitch black.
Well, yeah.
So, like, you can't even look through the house.
Yeah. So, yeah, try to navigate. Okay. Okay. That makes more sense why Amber was still in the master bedroom.
Yeah.
Try to navigate through smoke like that. You're going to become extremely disoriented.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And so, you or the listeners might be asking yourself, like, why the babies were on the floor, but...
They're babies.
Right? Okay, I didn't think it was that weird.
I sit on the floor all the time.
I didn't think it was that weird, but the article did make sure to say that Cameron and Stacy, after they woke up, they would let them drink their bottles on the ground, and the babies would sleep there. Like, this was a totally normal thing. It was not out of... It wasn't weird that they were on
the
ground.
Okay, is it weird to sit in the floor?
I mean, I eat on the floor.
I feel attacked. I like, there's a lot of times I go to sit, like, in front of my couch on the floor to watch TV. Yeah,
I sit in front of the couch. Yeah, so I was like, I don't think that's weird, but the person...
What was this time frame? 90s?
90s, yeah.
Dude, we sat on the floor.
And this is a very poor family, which we're about to get into, but they're very poor. Like, they were getting Christmas, you know, not to poor shame, but they got their Christmas gifts from the Salvation Army.
Yeah,
like
they're definitely sitting on the floor. We sat on the floor all the time.
Yeah. So, this was a terrible tragedy for the small town of Corsicana. Corsicana is a very small city that sits just about 50 miles northeast of Waco, and it was actually the center of Texas's first oil boom, but many of these wells had dried up, and more than a quarter of the city's 20,000 citizens were categorized like in severe poverty. Numerous stores along the main street were shuttered, and it seemed like hundreds of families were leaving daily, making it feel like an abandoned outpost.
Dang, that's serious.
So the people of Corsicana obviously felt bad for Stacy and Cameron. Just like many of these citizens, the Wilminghams were living in poverty, and they had virtually zero money. Cameron was an unemployed mechanic at the time of the fire, so he was mainly staying home and taking care of the babies,
right,
while Stacy worked in her brother's bar called Some Other Place. The townspeople were actually really nice, though, and they decided to try and help out, and they started to collect donations to pay for the funeral arrangements.
Aww.
So let's get into Cameron's background.
Mm-hmm.
Cameron was born in Ardmore, Oklahoma in 1968. When he was just a young boy, his mother actually left the family, and he was raised by his father, Gene, and his stepmother, Eugenia. Gene and Eugenia. His father, Gene, was a former U.S. Marine, and he worked in a salvage yard. The family lived in a very tiny, very cramped house, and at night they could hear the freight trains rattling the entire house on the nearby tracks.
I kind of want to be in a house when that goes by so I can see if I actually like it or not.
I don't think that you would like it.
No?
You don't like it when people sit on their patio. I don't think you'll like it when people...
Okay, I don't like people. But you know what? I think I like trains.
So Cameron was described as having what was called the classic Willingham look. He was a handsome man. He had thick black hair and dark eyes, which, I mean, he was very handsome. There'll be photos on the Instagram. During his time in high school, he struggled, and eventually he began to sniff paint. When he was just 17, the Oklahoma's... What? Yeah, that's a really common way that people get high.
I know you can, but, like...
Yeah.
That just sounds so ridiculous. He started sniffing paint.
And I didn't know, but you can, like... I don't know how you do it, but you can get high off of, like, Cool Whip.
Yeah, it's Whippets.
It's the gas, right? The gas thing or whatever? Yeah. I had no idea how it worked. I was like, what the fuck?
Yeah, people nowadays, instead of getting, like, Cool Whip and shit, they get, like, these tiny little silver bottles of Whippets. It's like, they're, like, little fucking nitrogen canisters or whatever the hell it is. People get high off that all the time. It was on Live PD. You know, before they... decided to skirt justice.
Yeah. So when he was just 17, Oklahoma's Department of Human Services evaluated Cameron, and they reported, quote, "He likes girls, music, fast cars, sharp trucks, swimming, and hunting," in that order.
Sounds like a guy from the 90s.
He sounds like a 16-year-old kid. Like, I don't know what else to say.
Yeah. He likes girls.
Cameron dropped out of high school and over time was arrested for driving under the influence, stealing bicycles, and just shoplifting, like petty crimes.
Yeah.
Well, driving under the influence is kind of not petty, but that was one of them. In 1988, he met Stacy, who was a senior in high school. She came from what the New Yorker article also called a troubled background. Which, I mean, this is terribly sad. When she was just 4 years old, her stepfather strangled her mother to death during a fight.
Oh, God.
Uh-huh. Stacy and Cameron had a very turbulent relationship. Cameron was often unfaithful. He would drink too much, and he would hit Stacy even when she was pregnant.
Okay.
So a neighbor once heard Cameron yelling, A neighbor once heard Cameron yelling at Stacy saying, quote, "Get up, bitch, and I'll hit you again." End
okay.
quote.
I'll get up. Try to hit me.
So Cameron is like not a good dude, right? Like this is all really bad things.
Yeah.
However, I don't think that you'll be able to draw your own conclusions, but I do not think that he started this fire and did not deserve to be executed because, spoiler alert, Cameron Todd Willingham was executed by the state of Texas.
When?
For a crime that he likely did not commit in the early 2000s.
Okay.
So, meanwhile, fire investigators were trying to determine the cause of the blaze. 4 days after the fire, Cameron had given some local arson investigators permission to search the house, telling them, quote, "I know that we might not ever know all of these answers, but I'd like to know why my babies were taken from me."
So, why did he need to give them permission?
I have no idea. That's just what the article said. That yeah, he like, was like, hey, you can look.
Yeah, if it's an arson investigation, I don't think they need your permission, bud.
Douglas Fogg, who at the time was the assistant fire chief, and Manuel Vasquez, who was the deputy fire marshal, began to search through the scene. During the search, they noticed some things that were, quote, unsettling.
Okay.
There was deep charring along the bottom of the walls, and this seemed weird to them because flames burn upward, but mm-hmm. this fire seemed to burn really low.
Which probably means there was some kind of like igniter poured at the bottom.
Well, we'll get into the science later.
Oh, good.
And there were weird patterns on the floor, almost like puddle shaped, where an accelerant mm-hmm. had pooled, right?
Okay.
The investigators explained that a flammable liquid, like dosed on the floor, will cause the fire to concentrate in these pools, which are, you know, called pore patterns or puddle configurations. The fire had burned through layers of carpeting and tile and plywood flooring.
Dang.
Moreover, the metal springs underneath the children's bed had turned white, a sign that intense heat had radiated underneath it.
Oh, okay.
So, seeing that the floor had the deepest burns, Manuel Vasquez assessed that it had been hotter than the ceiling, which, given that heat rises, said in his words, this was, quote, not normal.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. It's not normal. I'm just trying to think of what could be used as an accelerant that maybe children could have gotten into if this was an accident.
Okay.
That seems like a stretch, though.
Yeah. Douglas Fogg, the other investigator here, examined a piece of broken glass from one of the windows and noticed that it contained a spider web-like pattern. And this is what the investigators called, quote, crazed glass. And in forensic textbooks, this has long been described as a key indicator that a fire had burned, quote, fast and hot, meaning that it had likely been fueled by a liquid accelerant causing mm-hmm. the glass to fracture.
Well, okay, But he broke the glass.
Like, all the windows busted out, and, like, the pieces that busted out, like, had the crazed glass.
Okay, okay, apparently. So it's not just the bedroom window. It was a different window.
Yes.
Okay. That, I mean, that makes sense. I think there was an accelerant, especially if Diane from down the street can feel it before she can see it. Like, that's a hot-ass fire.
Yeah.
It's not going to burn like that on its own.
Well, it's raining really hard here, so I'm really sorry if you guys can hear it. So the two men continued their investigation, and they noticed what they called a burn trailer through the house. And I think they just mean like a trail, but
yeah.
It's apparently a trailer. It's always called this. It went from the children's bedroom, including underneath their beds, down the hallway, and out the front door.
Okay, and there's no way this could be, like, a gas line or anything like that?
I mean, it could be, but we'll get into it.
Okay.
Yeah. So, they found brown stains, which they concluded was consistent with the presence of an accelerant.
Okay.
They scanned the walls for soot marks that resembled a V shape. Because apparently when an object catches on fire, it creates a specific pattern. And as the heat and smoke radiate outward, the bottom of the V can point to where the fire began.
Okay.
So in the Willingham house, they found three distinct Vs. One in the hallway, one in the children's bedroom, and one at the front door. Manuel Vasquez later testified that multiple, like, origin points led him to one conclusion, and that it was that this fire was intentionally set by human hands.
Okay.
All right. So I'll agree. All this is looking really bad, okay?
Yeah. It doesn't mean that the dad did it.
Okay. We'll just keep going.
Okay. Keep going. Yeah.
By now, the investigators were, you know, shocked, but they had a clear idea of what happened. They assessed that someone had poured liquid accelerant through the children's bedroom, down the hallway, and out the front door, creating a fire barrier that prevented anyone from escaping.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Also, a prosecutor later suggested that the refrigerator in the kitchen had been moved to block the back door exit, and in short, the house had been turned into a death trap. So, a lab chemist also took samples from the house, and sure enough, the sample contained evidence of mineral spirits, which is a substance also that is often found in accelerants.
Okay. Oh, isn't it also in, like...
lighter fluid?
And also, like, paint thinner?
Oh, I have no idea about that, but...
and shit like that. I don't know. Is there anything in a mechanics world that would contain mineral spirits?
I mean, I'm sure. Girl, we'll get to what the mineral spirit is. All of this, like, without looking at science, looks really bad right now, right? Like, it looks like somebody probably set this house on fire. We'll get into this.
I, right now, am questioning the mom.
Okay,
I'm questioning the mom. Like, conveniently, all of the exits are blocked, and arson was done, completed, whatever, and she's out shopping, but that also sounds really judgmental.
When I first was getting into this, I was like, why are we even questioning this? Cameron is guilty, but you're about to learn, okay? So this fire is now being considered as a triple homicide, and Cameron Todd Willingham, the only person... besides, obviously, the victims, known to have been in the house at the time of the blaze, is now the prime suspect.
I don't know. Even if you think that he's guilty right now, it's still a lot to do with... okay, if he did this, why would he put the refrigerator at the back door?
So he did... they assess that he did that so that the girls couldn't leave through the back door.
The girls are one, and how old is Amber? Three? Two? Yeah. They're not going to leave through the back door.
That's their assessment. That's not my assessment. That's theirs. That's what they're saying.
The first thing Amber did is go to her dad's room and try to wake him up. So he was asleep.
Yeah. Well, that's Cameron's version of the story.
Right. So, I mean, the kids aren't going to run out the back. They're just not going to run out the back door.
Yeah.
I think they're just going to be too confused to do anything.
Yeah. I don't really know. But that's their assessment, so.
That's just a lot for him to go through to survive and kill his children.
Well, the police continue to investigate Cameron, and they obviously learn about his troubled past. They canvass the neighborhood and interviewed witnesses.
You shouldn't be able to bring someone's past into it. I'm sorry.
Find the evidence. Well, I think that sometimes, in this case, I think that they're wrong, but I do think that sometimes a, quote, like, life of crime does point to you being guilty. Like, if someone was robbing this gas station.
But what you're supposed to do is take that information and use it to get actual evidence that could convict somebody, because it's the truth and not just a conviction. But that's not how we operate, apparently.
No, but what I'm saying is, like, okay, if I have two suspects and so I'm investigating a gas station robbery. I got two suspects. One guy's robbed 5 gas stations before. The other guy's driven drunk. I'm going to look a little bit harder at the guy who has more of this.
Yeah, look at it, but, like, it shouldn't be used as evidence. I think it should be used to, like, help point in the direction that the evidence tells you, or, like, if you need a suspect.
Well, their evidence is telling them that Cameron did it.
Well, how? No, your evidence is telling you that there was an arson. It doesn't tell you who did it.
Well,
it tells you someone set a fire.
Yeah, and they're... Okay, well, let's just move on. Their evidence is telling them that Cameron's the guy that did it, and they're using his past as, like, supplemental information, saying, look at this guy. He has a bad past. He probably did this. I mean, if I'm a biased investigator, that all fits my story perfectly with a bow. Bam.
Yes, and that's the problem.
Yeah, not disagreeing on that, but I'm saying that I understand how they look at him as the prime suspect.
Yeah.
I do. I think they're wrong, but I understand how they looked at him.
What's his criminal past? What makes him think that his criminal past would just jump to arson?
His criminal past was beating his wife even while she was pregnant.
You know what?
Driving under the influence.
Never mind.
Shoplifting.
Disregard all of what I said. I would look at this guy too.
I was like, I don't understand why Kayla's not.
Sorry. I get it. Take that into account. Use it against him. Fuck this guy.
So they also went on to interview witnesses. Several, like Father George, whatever, the guy who was trying to calm him down, initially in their interviews said that Cameron was devastated by the fire, right? Mm-hmm. Yet over time, an increasing number of the witnesses offered damning statements. Like, at first they were like, yeah, he was so sad. So they were, slowly changing their assessments of how he was acting.
And when you look into, witness statements are obviously, like, not reliable at all.
Mm-mm.
But the further out you get from the incident that happened, the less truth that they have in them. So it should be taken with a grain of salt, and we should only take, the first statement, unless they can have absolute proof that they lied in the first statement.
No, I agree. Definitely unreliable.
Honestly, they should be thrown out, because if you're going to contradict your statement, it should be completely thrown out.
Yes.
Because you're lying at some point.
Or you're fabricating, you're completely... I don't think any of them lied intentionally. I think that they were just like, yeah, the more that I think about it, like, he could be a suspect.
Sure, and it's because they've learned whatever they've learned, and they're like, oh yeah, it was him. Because
they've learned that the police are investigating it, and they're like, yeah, that is a little weird, right? So, Diane Barbie said that she had not seen Cameron try to enter the house until after authorities arrived, as if he was putting on a show.
Wait, didn't she say he tried to enter before?
After the authorities arrived. The point of Cameron trying to break into the windows, that's his statement.
Okay. Yeah, but she ran back to call the fire department.
Okay, right?
So
she was gone. Hers doesn't matter. And when the children's room exploded, She said that Cameron seemed more preoccupied with his car because he moved it down the driveway.
Maybe he didn't want it to explode.
Valid concern. I agree. Another neighbor reported that when Cameron cried out for his babies, he, quote, did not appear to be excited or concerned. Even...
Do you want me to be excited that my children are burning?
Yeah. Even Father George wrote in a statement that upon further reflection, things were not as they seemed. Quote, he seemed to have the type of distress that a woman who had given birth would have upon seeing her children die.
End quote. Okay. You, sir, go back to your church and repent for your sins.
Ready to rage?
Jesus fucking Christ.
I think that both fathers and mothers can have relationships and care for their children. I don't understand what he is even trying to say. He was essentially saying, like, there's no way he could be that sad because he didn't give birth to the children.
That's he was wrong, a stay-at-home dad.
And he's their dad.
I'm sorry, that, like, was loud.
He's their dad at the end of the day.
He wasn't some detached father. Yeah. He was a stay-at-home dad who stayed home with his children every day. Because he wasn't working at the time. Like, he's going to be attached to his children. He can react however he pleases.
Yeah. So, on December 31st, 8 days after the fire, the police brought Cameron in for an official interrogation. Fogg and Vasquez, the two fire investigators, were present, along with Jimmy Hensley, who was a police officer working his very first arson case.
Okay.
So Cameron explained that Stacy had left the house that morning to shop for presents at the Salvation Army. Quote, after she got out of the driveway, I heard the twins cry, so I got up and I gave them bottles, he told the investigators. The children's room had a safety gate across the doorway, which Amber could climb over, but the twins could not. Mm-hmm. And he and Stacy, like we were saying earlier, let the kids nap on the floor after they drank their bottles.
Mm-hmm.
At this time, Amber was still in bed, so Cameron went back to his room to go back to sleep. Quote, the next thing I remember is hearing, Daddy, Daddy, and the house full of smoke. Cameron went on to say that he got up, felt around on the floor for a pair of jeans, and put them on. The house was completely black with smoke, so he couldn't see anything, but by that point, Amber had stopped speaking wherever she was at. He yelled, Amber, get out of the house, and he had no idea that she'd been in the room with him that time.
Okay, so he's waking up from a sleep. He's probably super foggy. If she hadn't called out for him, he probably would have died of smoke inhalation.
Yes, yeah.
So, yeah, I don't think he did it at this point.
Cameron then went on to say that he went into the twins' bedroom, but again, there was so much smoke that he couldn't see. And so he got down on his hands and knees to feel around for his babies, which he knew were on the floor. And at one point, he thought that he had... Oh, God. I'm going to cry. At one point, he thought he grabbed one of them, but it was actually a doll.
Aww.
He said that he could hear light sockets and light switches popping, and the house smelled the way it had smelled when their microwave had blown up just about 3 weeks earlier. So it smells like an electrical fire.
Okay.
Ugh. He then stood up in the children's bedroom and he said that his hair caught out. He said that his hair caught on fire and he patted it out and kept trying to feel around in the dark. He said he couldn't bear the heat any longer and that he was about to pass out. Cameron had to stumble down the hallway out the front door, and at that point when he makes it out the front door, he sees Diane and yells at her to call for the fire department. After she left and went to go call, he insisted that he tried to get in with no success. So the breaking the windows, that's where Cameron said that he had started it. Or had tried to get in, whatever. The investigators asked Cameron if he had any idea how the fire had started. He said that he wasn't sure, though it must have originated from the children's room since that was where he first saw the flames and that's where they were the thickest.
Mm-hmm.
He and Stacy had used 3 space heaters to keep the house warm, and one of them was in the children's room. Quote, I taught Amber not to play with it, he said, adding that she would get whoopings every once in a while for messing with it. He said he didn't know if the heater had an internal flame, which was possibly turned on. The investigators knew that there were space heaters in the house, but Vasquez later testified at trial that when he checked the heater in the children's room 4 days after the fire, it was in the off position.
How likely?
Yeah. They asked him if anyone would want to hurt his family, and he said no. No one... Oh, someone's knocking on our door. They asked him if anyone would want to hurt his family, and he said no. No one would be that cold-blooded. He told them that he and Stacy had their problems, but the children were what kept them together. Thinking of Amber, he said, quote, "To tell you the honest to God's truth, I wish she hadn't woken me up." The investigators then asked if he put shoes on that day. Since he had taken the time to put on pants, how about shoes? And Cameron responded, no. A map of the house was on the table between the men, and Manuel pointed to it and said, you walked out this way. And Cameron said, yes. So at this point, Manuel Vasquez is completely convinced that Cameron had murdered his children. If the floor had been soaked with a liquid accelerant and the fire had burned low, as the evidence suggested, Cameron could not have run out the house the way he described without his feet being burned badly, and a medical report indicated that his feet had not been burned at all. Okay? So this fire's burning low, Cameron's feet aren't burned. But Cameron had an explanation. He said that when he left the house, the fire was still around the top of the walls and not at the floor. Quote, "I didn't have to jump through any flames," he told them. Manuel believed that this was impossible and that he had lit the fire as he was walking out of the house, first torching the children's bedroom, the hallway, and then from the front porch, the front door, which is where all the V shapes were found.
Okay, but he wouldn't have had the soot on his chest.
Right? There's a lot of evidence that contradicts this nice little, yeah, you know, theory of theirs. Vasquez later said at trial, quote, "He told me a story of pure fabrication. He just talked and talked, and all he did was lie."
That's your opinion. Somebody, right? Please, yep, fucking interject here. That is your opinion, and it has nothing to do with this case.
Yes.
But also, if there are space heaters, then the liquid that fuels the space heater from the 90s is going to be an accelerant.
Yeah. I'm not sure what kind of space heater it was, but the accelerant will come back. Don't you worry. You don't have to worry about theorizing with that.
Mm.
But still, there was no clear motive on why Cameron would do this. The children had life insurance policies, but they amounted to only $15,000, which, I mean, that is a lot of money, but I don't think that's a lot of money to kill three children.
It's not, because he's going to spend that on their funerals.
Yes. And Stacy's grandfather was the one who was listed as the beneficiary.
Mm.
And Stacy went on to tell investigators that even though Cameron hit her, he'd never abuse their children. Quote, "Our kids were spoiled rotten," and she did not believe that Cameron could have killed them. So ultimately, the authorities concluded that Cameron was a man without a conscience, and his serial crimes had climaxed to murder.
Oh, okay.
John Jackson, who was the assistant district attorney in Corsicana, was assigned to prosecute Cameron's case. He later told the Dallas Morning News that he considered Cameron to be a, quote, "utterly sociopathic individual who deemed his children an impediment to his lifestyle." Wow, I swear to God, I'm actually a smart person.
Okay, first of all, also an opinion that's not brought up by any fact or science, yeah, or research whatsoever. Also, I don't remember you being a profiler, so sit down.
And it's very sensationalized, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's very much like, oh my God. Also, the local district attorney, Pat Batchelor, put it as, quote, "the children were interfering with Cameron's beer drinking and dart throwing, and that's why he murdered them."
You can have kids and still drink beer and throw darts.
On the night of January 8th, 1992, 2 weeks after the fire, Cameron was arrested and charged with the murder of his children. So John Jackson, who again was assigned to prosecute this case, was actually personally opposed to the death penalty. Which, same. He stated that he didn't think it worked, it wasn't effective at deterring criminals, and was extremely expensive. So, Jackson also said, quote, "What's the recourse if you make a mistake? What if you are wrong?" Foreshadowing?
Wow.
But Pat, his boss, the actual district attorney, was like, hey, this guy murdered his children. Also, welcome to Texas, where we don't give a fuck about life, even though we claim to be pro-life. So, you know.
Oh, yeah. Now they're doing that whole, like, fucking abortion law.
Yeah. Too political? Don't give a fuck. Fuck Texas. In the end, John Jackson did pursue the death penalty in this case. Cameron, who, you know, as we said before, was very poor, obviously couldn't afford to hire lawyers and was assigned to by the state. David Martin, who was a former state trooper, and Robert Dunn, who was a local defense attorney who represented basically everyone from like divorce cases to alleged murders. And he calls himself, quote, a jack of all trades.
I'm sure. So he specializes in nothing, basically.
Yes, specializes in nothing.
You can't really fault him. He's a public defender.
In a small town.
Yeah. And then you have a state trooper. Like, I feel like that's a bias. No offense. Mm-hmm.
All right. Not long after Cameron's arrest, authorities received a message from a prison inmate named Johnny Webb, who was in the same jail as Cameron.
Oh, boy. I bet he's got information so he can get a lighter sentence.
Oh, girl. So, Johnny Webb alleged that Cameron had confessed to him, saying that Cameron, quote, took some kind of lighter fluid squirting around the walls and the floor and set a fire.
Objection. That's hearsay.
So at this point, the prosecutors are like, this case is air fucking tight.
It is confessed. Not.
It is not at all.
That, okay, the person in the jail, the prison, wherever the hell they are, first of all, what are they in
obviously
there for?
Obviously lying.
What did they do? Is he a cellmate? Wait, why would anyone fucking, why would anyone even admit to that? Why?
This is the worst part. Johnny Webb was not Cameron's cellmate. Johnny Webb alleges that when he was walking by Cameron's cell, Cameron said, hey, come here, and spoke to Johnny through, like, the food tray and confessed.
No, he didn't.
Hey, and, ask the prosecutors.
Absolute fucking lie. First of all, no one's going to say that. And especially in jail, you're not going to admit to something or say that you did something just so people will leave you alone. You have to actually show it. You have to beat the shit out of somebody first.
And in my opinion, murdering three children, anything with children, puts a bigger target on your back.
Yeah, because, no, they're not going to stand
jailhouse
for that.
Jailhouse justice, baby.
Exactly.
They will not fuck with that.
Anything with children or anything heinous like that, they will not stand for it.
They don't fuck with that shit.
Yeah, so, okay, that's a fucking lie. Oh, also, did we get any of, like, the cameras from the jail to see if this guy had any kind of contact whatsoever?
This dude lied out his ass, and he got a deal from the prosecution.
Of course he did, and that should be considered a bribe.
We get into that. So, one of Cameron's own lawyers even openly admits that he thought Cameron was guilty. David Martin, the state trooper.
You should recuse yourself. Of course it's the state trooper.
He said, quote, all the evidence showed that he was 100% guilty. He poured accelerant all over the house and put lighter fluid under the kid's bed. He said it was a, quote, classic arson case.
Nope. Speculation.
There were, quote, puddle patterns all over the place. No disputing those.
Sure. How does that prove that Cameron did it?
So the prosecution approached the defense and said, hey, we think this is airtight. We got a plea deal. If Cameron would plead guilty, the state would give him a life sentence without the chance of parole and would not pursue the death penalty.
No.
Martin and Dunn advised Cameron that he should accept the offer, but Cameron refused.
I would have fired them.
Well, he's also, he dropped out of high school. He has no money. Yeah. I would say that he probably doesn't understand.
Oh, yeah, you're right. But you could tell the judge that at least one of your lawyers is biased against you, that he needs to recuse himself, and that you need a different public defenders.
Yeah.
You have the right to a fair trial, and this is not fair by any means.
No, but I think a lot of people don't know that.
Yeah. How do they put the accelerant in Cameron's hands? You have to put that in his hands. Just because you're saying there was an accelerant, and I agree with you, there's an accelerant.
Oh, let's just keep going, okay? After Cameron was like, no, I'm not taking the plea deal, the two lawyers asked that his father and stepmother come to speak to him.
My.
So according to Eugenia, one of Cameron's lawyers showed Eugenia and Jean photos of the burned children's bodies.
Okay, first of all, that should be illegal.
And told them, quote, look what your son did. You have to talk to him into pleading or he's going to be executed, end quote. Cameron's own lawyer showed them that.
Well, yeah, it's probably the state trooper.
Yeah, both of them.
Okay.
So his parents went to see their son in jail, and Cameron's father, Eugene, told him that he should not take the plea deal if he was innocent, which I agree. But Cameron's stepmother begged him to take the deal, saying, quote, I just want to keep my boy alive, she told the New Yorker. But Cameron refused, and he said he would not plead guilty because he did not do it.
Mm-hmm.
In August of 1992, Cameron's trial officially began, and it lasted 2 days.
Sorry? okay, hang on. He was arrested in January.
Uh-huh.
In August is when his trial began. So it's uh-huh. longer wait time for the trial to start than the trial actually gets. Mm-hmm. I think you should have to at least spend an entire week on a trial.
There's a problem with 2 days, but yes, I agree. This whole case is botched, right?
Yeah, the whole thing.
And a man died because of it.
Yeah, and I'm sure the jury didn't do the reasonable doubt thing like they always do. They just probably weren't sequestered, so they probably had all the information from the media, and it was obviously sensationalized, and they just said, oh yeah, you did it. Because if your own witnesses are going to go back later and recant some of the things that they said and go, oh yeah, he probably did it, then I guarantee you the jury was not sequestered either.
Yeah. So the prosecution during this trial argued that this was actually Cameron's third attempt at killing his children.
How?
They assessed that Cameron attempted to end all of Stacy's pregnancies by kicking her in the stomach, hoping she would miscarry. Which I'm like, okay, he beat his wife. Let's not, flutter around that. But did he beat his wife hoping that she would miscarry? And if he did, how do you prove that beyond a reasonable doubt? You just can't.
No, they just came up with it. He more than likely didn't even kick her in the stomach. He might have, but he more than likely didn't. But how do they even know if he did or did not?
Well,
they are creating a fucking narrative.
Well, he was arrested for domestic violence, so they do know that he was violent with her.
Right, but where's the evidence of where he hit her? Because it should be there.
Well, the evidence, I don't care. I mean, it's really bad if he hit her in the stomach.
Yes.
But the thought is what matters here. Did you hit her saying, I'm going to kill these babies, I'm going to get her to miscarry? Or did you hit her saying, I'm really upset and her stomach is what I hit? There's two different things.
I'm not condoning that he hit her, but there is a difference in if he hit her in the face, absolutely no person would think that she would miscarry because of that. So you can't prove that that was his intent.
Yeah, I don't think that you 100% cannot prove that he was hitting her to have her miscarry.
Here's a lesson learned. Don't beat your wife.
Yeah, number one, don't beat your wife. So the prosecution obviously thought they had this great case. They brought out Johnny Webb, the jailhouse informant, and Johnny told them, yep, one day I was walked by Cameron's cell and we talked through the food slot. He told me he lit the house on fire. He poured lighter fluid in the children's room in the shape of a pentagram. Cameron told Johnny that he did it because Stacy had hurt one of the kids and Cameron had to cover it up that she'd hurt one of them.
That's not true. It's the 90s. You just don't report it.
And a pentagram, like, you're just trying to, like, profit off of the satanic panic.
Yeah, you're fabricating a story. There's no evidence that it was drawn into pentagram whatsoever. Therefore, it should have been thrown out. The judge should not have allowed this guy. And you just said you talked through a food slot, so how do you know that it was Cameron?
So, Diane Barbie and her daughter also testified.
How old was her daughter?
I think she was like 11 or 12 when this happened. So what, she's probably 12, 13.
Yeah.
And of course, the fire investigators, Douglas Fogg and Manuel Vasquez, also testified. They were, of course, the stars of this trial because they were called forward as experts.
You have to go through a rigorous certification
to be considered
expert testimony.
It's not that rigorous. So Manuel said they identified over 10 indicators of arson, and in his expert opinion,
what were they?
Cameron started the fire. The V-shape, the puddles, the cracked glass, all that is his indicators of arson. So the defense did barely anything to defend Cameron. They attempted to find a fire investigator that didn't agree with Fogg and Manuel, and the one guy that they found agreed with their conclusion. So, like, they couldn't even find someone to help. And at this point, it basically looks like the defense gave up.
Yeah, that's exactly what it looks like.
They called one witness to the stand who was a babysitter, and she basically said, yeah, I don't think that he could have done this. Cameron wanted to take the stand, but his lawyers told him that he shouldn't. Which, I mean, yeah, you probably shouldn't take the stand in your own defense. I agree. The jury went on, deliberated for barely an hour before returning a unanimous guilty verdict.
Yeah, they didn't listen to anything. Well, there was no defense, so...
Yeah, they only listened to the prosecution. So several family members, including Stacy, testified during the penalty phase, and they asked that they spare Cameron's life. While Stacy was on the stand during this time, John Jackson, the attorney, prosecutor, sorry, grilled her about the significance of Cameron's, quote, very large tattoo of a skull encircled by some kind of serpent. Stacy responded, it's just a tattoo. To which John Jackson said, he likes snakes and skulls. Is that what you're saying? And Stacy went on to say, no, he just had a tattoo. Like, it's literally just a tattoo.
Yeah, what are you trying to say here?
The prosecution cited that this skull and snake tattoo, along with music posters within the house, were evidence that Cameron fit the profile of a sociopath. And they brought forth two medical experts to confirm this theory. Neither of these, quote, experts met Cameron, and one of them was Tim Gregory, who was a psychologist with a master's degree in marriage and family issues. Doesn't even
work in the realm. What does that have to do with it?
Exactly. Who had previously gone hunting with John Jackson, the prosecutor, and had not published any research in the field of sociopathic behavior.
Therefore, he cannot be considered an expert.
The other medical expert was James P. Grixon, a forensic psychiatrist. He testified so often for prosecutions and capital punishment cases that he'd become known as Dr. Death. James Grixon suggested that Cameron was a, quote, extremely severe sociopath and that no pill or no treatment could help him.
Based on what?
And just a quick note, in 1995, 3 years after Cameron's trial, James was expelled from the American Psychiatric Association for violating ethics.
Wow.
They stated that he repeatedly arrived at psychiatric diagnoses without first having examined the individual in question. And he indicated, while testifying at court as an expert witness, that he could 100% say that the individual would engage in further violent acts, and you cannot assess that.
This guy's a fucking quack.
Yep. So on October 29th, 1992, Cameron was sentenced to death for the murder of his three children.
I think that the expert medical examiner who said he was a sociopath 100% should be charged with capital murder.
Yeah, he got a bunch of people murdered, yeah. Essentially.
Yeah, he should be charged. And he should be...
In prison.
Yeah, he should.
And for the rest of his life, yeah.
Because, yeah, it was intentional. You testified so that these people could have the death penalty put on them, and... Your ethics are obviously called into question, and you've been...
And your nickname is Dr. Death?
Yeah.
So Cameron's parents lived in Oklahoma, and they would come to visit him about once a month. But in the end, it was basically a lonely existence for Cameron.
Yeah.
He made some friends while in prison, but he was on death row, so obviously all of his friends were put to death at one point. And Cameron later wrote in letters that he was surrounded by people that he, quote, had no business being with.
Yeah.
Cold-blooded murderers, serial killers, rapists. I mean, it was awful.
Hmm.
So days turned into months and months turned into years for Cameron on death row. But finally, things started to happen and elements of the case against Cameron began to fall apart. A French teacher and a playwright from Houston, Texas, named Elizabeth Gilbert, began corresponding with Cameron. They started by writing letters together, and she was actually struck by how thoughtful and genuine Cameron seemed. So she decided that she would help look into his case. She talked with Stacy, and Stacy was certain that on the morning of the fire, the space heater in the children's bedroom had been on.
Mm-hmm.
On more than one occasion, Stacy had caught Amber putting things too close to the space heater or even putting things in it. And so Stacy wondered if Amber had accidentally put something too close or messed with it, and that's what caused the fire.
Yeah.
So Elizabeth kept digging around, and she noticed that the witnesses kept changing their minds on when they first saw Cameron in the fire and when he became a suspect. Then there was the jailhouse snitch, Johnny Webb. Johnny was not doing good at this point. He was suffering from PTSD and his memory was spotty, and in his own words, he said that he, quote, had a mental impairment.
Are you kidding me?
The prosecution later admitted they thought Johnny was an unreliable guy, but they thought that he was telling the truth about Cameron because what motive did he have to lie? Well, let me give you a motive.
Yeah, the tons of motives. Yeah.
Johnny was supposed to be in prison for 15 years, but as soon as he was up for parole the first time around, John Jackson, the prosecutor, lobbied for him to be released.
Oh.
He said that he should be released, and he was. Within a month, he returned to prison for a cocaine charge. But John Jackson said that Johnny should have been released because he was targeted by the Aryan Brotherhood, not because it was some kind of secret deal.
It was a secret deal.
It was a very much a secret deal. Over the years, Johnny has recanted his recantation of Cameron. When the reporter from the New Yorker interviewed Johnny, he said, quote, "My memory's in bits and pieces. I was on a lot of medication. Everyone knew that. The statute of limitation has run out on perjury, hasn't it?" So he was literally asking if he could be in trouble for lying on the stand.
So did Cameron not get any appeals?
Oh, well, he did, but I believe... We'll just keep going.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that.
Because he could have easily... There's so many things that he could have cited to get himself out or a retrial on appeal.
Yes. Okay, anyway. So during this time, Cameron still has the shitty lawyers who did absolutely nothing for him.
Mm-mm.
He tried to study law himself, but later confessed to a friend, quote, "The law is so complicated, it's hard for me to understand." Which, like, you know, I'm not a lawyer by any means, and I'm not a pre-law, but I am criminology, and I've taken a lot of criminal law classes, and it is very hard to understand. Yeah.
It is.
That's me with a professional in the room.
And you have to read and reread and reread and reread. Yeah. And then you have to read case law and what happened with specific cases to see how it was decided.
Precedent. Yeah, it's very hard. In 1996, Cameron finally attained a new court-appointed lawyer named Walter Reeves.
Thank God.
Walter was appalled by the quality of Cameron's defense at trial, and he tried filing a writ of habeas corpus, but it didn't work.
Why not?
So Walter actually focused on procedural errors during the trial, and he didn't question if Johnny Webb or if the arson experts were full of shit.
Why wouldn't you just cite all of it?
No idea. But they kept working, kept filing appeals, and in 2003, the appeals actually made it all the way to the United States Supreme Court, but they declined to hear the case.
How can you decline to hear the case? You should have to hear it.
They're picky as fuck. Well, you would think that, like, you would think that the Texas Appeal Court would hear it. But yeah, I made it all the way to the Supreme Court, and they deny thousands of cases every year. There's like a standard that each case has to meet, which is why they haven't ruled on abortion in a very long time, because apparently it's not the right time to rule on it. It's really interesting. If anyone's interested in how the Supreme Court chooses their cases, I would love to do a mini episode on that, because I think it's cool. It's wrong, but it's cool. So the state of Texas finally gave Cameron a death day. On February 17th, 2004, Cameron Todd Willingham was to be put to death at 6 p.m. by lethal injection.
Thank you.
So Cameron did have one card left to play, and that was to appeal to the Texas governor, Rick Perry, for a pardon. And this seems hopeless, right?
Mm-hmm.
But getting into an amazing part of this story... 1 month before Cameron was scheduled to die, a man named Dr. Gerald Hurst heard about Cameron's case.
Okay.
So Dr. Hurst has a PhD. He's actually an expert. And he was known as the arson guy, right?
Okay.
He was an acclaimed and accomplished scientist, and he was the best of the best. He received a PhD in chemistry from Cambridge University. He later went on to work for the Department of Defense as the chief scientist on a secret weapons program for several American companies designing rockets and deadly firebombs and basically a lot of bad shit.
But, like, and guy knows about chemicals and fire.
He knows his shit, yeah. And when he spoke with the New Yorker, this article, he said that he realized that his line of work was morally wrong, and so he quit.
Mm-hmm.
He left the defense industry and he went on to invent a bunch of shit, things such as the Mylar balloon, an improved version of liquid paper, and just like a whole range of things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And because of his extraordinary knowledge of fire and explosive and accelerants, companies in civil litigations often sought his help in determining the cause of the fire. And by the 90s, he had begun devoting a significant amount of his criminal arson, of his time, to investigating these arson cases, and he was exposed to the methods of local and state fire investigators and was shocked by what he saw.
Oh, good.
Many arson investigators, it turns out, only had a high school education. In most states, in order to be certified as an arson investigator, you had to take one 40-hour course on fire investigation and pass one written exam.
What the fuck?
Often, the bulk of an investigator's training came from on the job, which I'm like, okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
But they were learning from the, quote, old-timers in this field who passed on a body of wisdom and telltale signs of arson, even though it was warned that there was nothing scientific to substantiate their validity. This is what it looks like. This is it. We know because it's always been like this. Wrong.
No.
So in 1992, the National Fire Protection Association actually published its first scientifically based guidelines on how to investigate arson. But many arson investigators went on to believe that what they did was more of an art than an actual science, so they didn't need these scientific guidelines.
It's a science. You don't just get to choose.
Egg fuck exactly, bro. So by the year 2000, the courts were like, hey, take your art somewhere else. What you do needs to be based on science.
Yeah.
So the arson investigators were forced to use these specific scientific methods, but even then, there remained and still are great variances in this field, with many investigators still relying on unverified techniques that had been used for generations. Doctor,
those guys should be fired.
Seriously. Dr. Hurst, the arson dude, was quoted as saying, quote, people investigated fire largely with a flat earth approach. It looks like arson, therefore it must be arson, end quote. So Dr. Hurst learns about Cameron's case, and he's like, yeah, I'll take this pro bono. Let's fucking go.
Nice.
And just a quick reminder, this is 1 month before Cameron was supposed to die. And to absolutely nobody's surprise, Dr. Hurst found a bunch of shady shit.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing of note is that Fire Marshal Manuel Vasquez had told the court that he had investigated between 1,200 and 1,500 fires in his career, and nearly all of them had been arson. Which, this is oddly high, consider that the Texas State Fire Marshals only find about 50% of their annual cases to be arson. So he's lying.
Yeah, he's lying, and there's something wrong with his techniques.
Yes.
Statistically, you shouldn't have that many.
Yes. So Dr. Hurst was also skeptical of Manuel's claim that the fire had burned, quote, fast and hot, only because of a liquid accelerant. This notion had actually been repeated by arson investigators for decades, but this theory is actually nonsense. Numerous experiments have proven that while an accelerant affects the speed at which a fire burns, it does not increase the temperature.
Really?
So, Hurst was able to refute all of the evidence that an accelerant had been used in the fire.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the investigators thought an accelerant had been used based on the patterns of the glass windows. Yet, in November of 1991, you remember the crazed glass or whatever?
Yeah.
In November of 1991, a team of fire investigators inspected 50 houses in the hills of Oakland, California that had been burnt down by like forest fires.
Okay.
In dozens of houses, the investigators discovered the crazed glass, even though no liquid accelerant had been used in these fires.
Okay, so it doesn't point to an accelerant, it just points to
a fire.
The windows were blown out. Yeah.
And most of these houses that had this crazed glass were on the outskirts of the blaze where firefighters had shot streams of water into the houses to put it out.
Oh.
And the investigators later wrote in a published and peer-reviewed study that the fracturing within the glass had actually been caused by rapid cooling, not by sudden heat.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yes, and that it was a thermal shock which caused the glasses to contract so quickly that it basically cracked itself.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yes, so the investigators then tested this hypothesis in a laboratory. When they heated the glass, nothing happened. There was no crazed glass. But each time they applied cold water to the heated glass, the intricate patterns appeared.
Okay.
Dr. Hurst had also noticed this same phenomenon when he had blowtorched and then immediately cooled glass during his research at Cambridge. In the report, he stated that Vasquez and Fogg's notion of crazed glass was no more than a, quote, old wives' tale. So he then went on to examine these brown stains that Fogg and Vasquez noted on the Willingham's front porch, which they claimed were evidence of the liquid accelerant.
Okay.
Hurst previously performed a test in his garage in which he poured charcoal lighter fluid on the concrete floor and lit it. When the fire went out, on this concrete floor, there were no brown stains, only smudges of soot.
Mm-hmm.
Hurst ran this experiment many times with different kinds of accelerants on different concrete floors, and the results were always the same. Brown stains were common in fires, and they were usually composed of rust or gunk from charred debris that was mixed with the water from fire hoses and not from a liquid accelerant.
Okay, so all of the puddling that they're saying happened in the kids' bedroom and in the front where they thought all of the fire...
Accelerants pool.
So it's just the points at where the firefighters were putting the water because that's where it was burning the most.
It's the water pooling within this house. Being mixed... It makes complete sense. With all of this debris. So Hertz then confronted some of the most damning evidence against Cameron. The burned trailer or trail, I don't know why they call it a trailer, the pore patterns, and the burn marks. Also, how was Cameron able to get out of the house without burning his feet?
Yeah.
So Dr. Hertz then referred to a very famous fire that occurred in 1990. And this fire is considered famous because arson investigators learned so much. And it's like creepily similar to Cameron's case. So, on October 15th, 1990, a man was found outside of his home holding his three-year-old while his house burned in Jacksonville, Florida. By the time this fire was extinguished, six people had died, including this man's wife. There were the, quote, classic signs of arson here. Low burn marks along the wall, pore patterns on the floor, V-shaped patterns from where the man had claimed the fire had started. This man had also been previously sent to jail for domestic violence, and neighbors said that he wasn't, quote, emotional enough while the fire was burning. He was then charged with six murders. But, this case takes a turn from Cameron's because the investigators actually investigated the fire.
Wow.
So they decided to do an experiment.
Mm-hmm.
There was an abandoned house right next to the house that had been burned, and they set it on fire without an accelerant, fully expecting that it would look totally different from the house that had burned. But that's not what happened. After the fire was put out and they started to investigate, this house displayed signs of pore patterns, puddles, and charring at the base of the wall, V-shaped burn marks from where they started the pattern. So it turns out that these classic, sure signs of arson
are just signs naturally. Of fire. Yeah.
Yes.
Wow.
Also, Cameron's feet had not been burned, because if there was an accelerant used in the fire would have been relatively cool before it reached its flash point. So suddenly Cameron's story makes a lot more sense. Mm-hmm. So the only thing that Dr. Hurst found that could be a sign of arson was the presence of the mineral spirits.
Okay.
Right? So Dr. Hurst begins to dig into this, and he found that the samples taken from the home were only taken from the front porch.
Okay.
But Gerald was like, okay, why wasn't the mineral spirits found on the samples that were throughout the rest of the house?
Yeah.
So I think I may have said that confusing, but mineral spirits was only found on the samples taken on the front porch.
Okay,
not in the rest of the house.
Which could happen at any point. So shit from out... Yeah, okay.
Turns out the Willinghams kept their grill on the front porch. And what do you keep with the grill?
There you go.
Charcoal lighter fluid.
There you go. Holy shit.
So without even having visited the fire scene, Dr. Hurst says that it is impossible to pinpoint the cause of the base. But based on all of the evidence, he believes that it was an accidental fire. One that was most likely caused by a space heater or faulty electrical wiring.
Mm-hmm.
This explains why there's no good motive for the crime.
Mm-hmm.
And he also concluded that there is no evidence of arson. He also explained that a man who had just lost his three children and spent 12 years in prison was about to be executed based on junk science.
Yeah.
He wrote his report in such a rush that he did not stop to fix any typos. So for the first time in a long time, Cameron had hope. Gerald Hurst was the arson guy, and surely the court would see through this junk science and see that he was innocent. Gerald Hurst had actually gotten a ton of people exonerated who were convicted of this same exact thing and put on death row. But Cameron Todd Willingham was not one of those people.
So what did they say about his report?
So apparently the board members who decide these cases don't have to review all of the new facts. The Innocence Project actually dug into this, and they found that this board had received Dr. Hurst's report, but didn't do much with it.
You're going to kill someone, read it.
Exactly. Fuck's sake. Lafayette Collins, who was a member of the board at the time that the report was received, told the New Yorker of the process, quote, "You don't vote guilt or innocence. You don't retry the trial. You just make sure everything is in order and there's no glaring errors." He noted that although the rules allowed for a hearing to consider important new evidence, quote, "In his time, there had never been one called." So when the author of the New Yorker, David, asked why Dr. Hurst's report didn't constitute evidence of glaring errors, Lafayette Collins said, quote, "We get all kinds of reports, but we don't have the mechanisms to vet them all." Alvin Shaw, who was another board member at the time, said that the case didn't, quote, "ring a bell," adding angrily, "Why would I want to talk about that?" Dr. Gerald Hurst later went on to call the board's action unconscionable.
Fire them all.
Yep.
Bring them up on charges. Murder.
On February 13th, 4 days before Cameron was scheduled to be executed, the Board of Pardon and Paroles denied his petition. So Cameron was going to die. He wrote a letter to Stacy apologizing for not being a better husband and thanking her for everything that she'd given him, especially his three daughters. He said that he hoped that, quote, "someday, somehow, the truth will be known and my name will be cleared." So Stacy came to visit him days before his death, and Cameron asked Stacy if his tombstone could be erected next to their children's graves. Stacy, who had for so long expressed belief in Cameron's innocence, had recently taken her first look at the original court records and arson findings. So she did not know of Dr. Hurst's report, and she determined that Cameron was guilty. She denied him his wish, later telling the reporter, quote, "He took my kids away from me."
He didn't.
So she didn't even know about the report.
I bet she feels like shit.
Then, on February 16th, the day before his execution, the prosecutors filed an affidavit signed by Stacy's brother. It said that Stacy had told him during that conversation with Cameron in the prison, Cameron confessed to killing the children.
No, he didn't.
I think that was a total lie. It didn't happen. On February 17th, 2004, Cameron Todd Willingham was to be put to death. He received word that Governor Perry refused to grant him a stay of execution, and Cameron's mother and father began to cry. So Cameron told his mother, quote, "Don't be sad, Mama. In 55 minutes, I'm a free man. I'm going to see my kids." Jesus Christ. So earlier, he confessed to his parents that there was only one thing about the day of the fire he lied about. He said that he never actually crawled into his children's room, saying, quote, "I just didn't want people to think that I was a coward."
There you go.
So Dr. Hurst told the New Yorker that, quote, "People who have never been in a fire don't understand why those who survive can't rescue the victims. They have no concept of what a fire is like," defending Cameron's statement.
Well, yeah. Okay. Take into account the heat, the smoke, You're probably not getting as much oxygen as you should be, so you're not thinking straight. You're scared. You're thinking about yourself. You're not thinking about other people.
Your body's natural reaction is to live. So, like,
that's exactly what he should have done. So, yeah, you can say he was a bad father, but he wasn't.
No.
And he did what he was supposed to do. So, I don't even, you can't judge somebody for that. You aren't in their shoes.
Yes, I agree. At 6 p.m., Cameron Todd Willingham was to be brought in, or I'm sorry, was brought in to be murdered by the state of Texas. He asked his parents not witness his death, so they didn't. He had asked Stacy not to be present, but she was there.
Because she's a bitch.
Just before Cameron, there is a part, it wasn't in the New Yorker, but it was in another article that when Cameron saw Stacy, he freaked out, calling her, you know, you fucking bitch, saying that she shouldn't be there. And he blames her that he didn't get the stay of execution because of the affidavit.
Yeah, it's her fault. She's a murderer.
Just before he received the lethal injection, he was asked if he had any last words. And he said, quote, "The only statement I want to make is that I am an innocent man convicted of a crime I did not commit. I have been persecuted for 12 years for something I did not do. From God's dust I came, and to dust I will return, so the earth shall become my throne." At 6:20 p.m., Cameron Todd Willingham's heart stopped, and his death certificate listed his cause of death as homicide.
Yeah.
Ugh. After his death, his parents were allowed to touch his face for the first time in more than a decade. Later, at Cameron's request, they cremated his body and secretly spread some of his ashes over his children's graves.
Good. Fuck you, Stacy.
In December of 2004, questions about the scientific evidence used in Cameron's case finally began to surface. Maurice Posley and Stephen Mills of the Chicago Tribune published an excellent investigative piece on the flaws in junk science that helped to convict Cameron. In 2006, the Innocent Project commissioned 4 top fire investigators in the nation to review the arson evidence against Cameron. They concluded in a report that each and every one of the indicators of arson had been proven to be scientifically invalid. In 2005, the Texas state government established a commission to investigate the errors of misconduct by forensic scientists. And Cameron's case was one of the first to be reviewed. The fire scientist who reviewed it was actually disgusted. He wrote in a scathing report that the investigators had no scientific basis for claiming that the fire was arson, ignored all evidence that contradicted their theory, had no comprehension of flashover and fire dynamics, relied on discredited folklore, and failed to eliminate potential accidental or alternative causes of fire. In the end, the state of Texas had executed a man that they could not prove was guilty.
Yep. Good job, Texas.
This report was obviously controversial, and that year, in 2005, Rick Perry was actually up for re-election. Just before the commission's final report was scheduled to be released, the chairman of the commission was fired. 2 more people on the commission were fired immediately following that, and then Rick Perry put a friend in charge of the commission.
Of course he did.
In 2012, Johnny Webb, the jailhouse informant, came forward and recanted his testimony for the final time.
Yep.
He said the prosecutor, John Jackson, had pressured him into making this statement and had offered him a secret deal in exchange for testifying against Cameron.
Yep, sounds right.
The Innocence Project looked into this as well and found documentation that backs up Johnny's story of a backdoor deal.
Yep.
John Jackson, of course, says that he never made any deals, but in March of 2015, the Texas State Bar filed disciplinary actions against Jackson for not disclosing the information on a deal with Johnny.
So what was his punishment?
I think he was just, like, disbarred.
Yeah, he should be put on criminal charges. It's called a bribe.
And that is the story of the tragic deaths of Cameron, Carmen, and Amber Willingham, and the murder of Cameron Todd Willingham by the state of Texas.
Great. Fucking swell.
And like, I, there's nothing I can do except laugh because it's just like, what the fuck, dude? What the fuck?
It doesn't surprise me at all. It's like, yeah, I mean, my case is going to be similar, but she's not dead. So she has hope of getting out, and the Innocence Project is looking into it. So we might even cover my case again if the Innocence Project finds and exonerates her. So
So we love that you're here. If you made it this far, my crying may have, you know, completely forced you to leave. Don't blame you.
No, it's fine.
Don't forget to like and rate and review us and tell your friends about us.
Yes.
And we'll talk to you guys next week.
All right. See you later.
Bye.